All right, well, we will go ahead and begin for tonight. We are in Revelation chapter 2, and tonight we're going to be looking at verses 12 through 17, which is Jesus' letter through John to the church at Pergamum. And I'll go ahead and begin by reading the text, and then we'll start studying it. To the angel in the church of Pergamum, you shall write, "Thus says the one having the sharp, two-mouthed broadsword, I have known where you dwell, where is the throne of Satan, and you hold my name and didn't deny my faith even in the days of Antipas, my faithful testifier, who was killed from you where Satan dwells. But I have against you a few things, that you have there ones holding to the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the sons of Israel, to eat idol meat and fornicate. In this manner, you also have ones holding to the teaching of the Nicolaitans likewise. Repent, therefore, and if not, I will come to you quickly, and I shall war with them by the broadsword of my mouth. The one having an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one conquering, I shall give to him some of the manna that was hidden, and I shall give him a white pebble, and upon the pebble a new name written, which no one knows except the one taking it." Okay, so first things first, what do we think? What are some exceptional observations, some things that stand out to us about the letter to the church at Pergamum? You would not want to be in the church at Pergamum. No, that is, I think probably everybody would agree, you don't necessarily want to be at that church. Why would you not want to be at the church? Yes, the throne of Satan is there. Yeah, there. That expression, the two-mouthed broadsword, is interesting. Now, do you have your English, your modern English translation right next to you? Most modern English translations are going to call that a double-edged broadsword, something to that effect. But it literally is a two-mouthed broadsword, which we'll see why that's significant later. But yeah, so he's immediately identifying himself as someone who is confrontational. When we look at Jesus's his appearance to the church in Ephesus, thus says the one holding the seven stars in the right, the one walking in the midst of the seven golden lampstands. I mean, that just shows Jesus being among his church and among his people. And I mean, sure, there may be some sense of sovereign judgment that's in there, but that's very subtle. The church at Smyrna, thus says the first and the last who became dead and lived, I have known your tribulation and your poverty. So again, his introduction, this, it follows the pattern where we have the recipient is named, to the angel at the church of wherever is named, and then the thus says, and then we have this identification of Jesus. And here, the identification of Jesus is immediately a confrontational presentation of Jesus. He is ready to make war. The word, and I've translated this as broadsword. You'll notice that there's other places in Revelation where we simply use the word sword. There are two words that are used in Revelation to refer to a sword. There's the word chrompha, and there's the word machaira. And machaira is the normal word for sword. But this chrompha, and I think I mentioned this here before, maybe last week, but this big sword that they're talking about is this big, two-handed, very long sword. One of the commentaries describes it as a sword that's almost like a spear. It's very long, and it has two edges. And these would often be, from what I've read, and this may be, I haven't been able to find anything in some really good antiquities books, but they talk about these being kind of ceremonial, these being executioner's swords is kind of the idea. Again, I can't verify that, but that's something I've seen in some, not disreputable, but less reputable sources. Maybe it hints at that. But immediately, we're given this presentation as someone who has this sharp, two-edged sword. And like you mentioned, Deanne, their church is where the throne of Satan is. What else do we notice about the church at Pergamum? What do we notice about this letter that stands out to us? Let me repeat that for those listening at home. So with a sword, you can be very specific and very precise with the way you use a sword, especially the Roman short sword is not this big, wild, you know, with loping swings weapon, but a big broadsword is. And so if the Machaira, if the Roman short sword is kind of a precision weapon, this one, Jesus doesn't need to come with precision when he's coming in judgment of the church at Pergamum, rather. There's no need to worry about whether he's going to hit the innocent. That's a really interesting take, and I think we're gonna come to that, because what you bring up is really significant, and I think is worth talking about. Other observations that we have. Who are the Nicolaitans? Besides Revelation, no. Not, I mean, I could be wrong, but I don't believe the Nicolaitans are mentioned anywhere else other than in these letters to the churches. So there are two major theories about who the Nicolaitans are. There are a couple. I think I mentioned this last week. There are some people who believe that they were the followers of Nicholas and Nicolaus. And Nicolaus, the theory is, was one of the deacons in the early church, appointed in Acts chapter 5 or 6, and that later he brought in destructive teaching. Other theories are that this Nicholas was somebody who brought clericalism in, that he brought in this idea of having priests that are separate from the people. Another is that it's a generalized name, because Niko in Greek, Niko means to conquer or to overcome, and Laos is people, so it's the overcoming of the people, somebody who overcomes the people, and that Nicolaitans are not necessarily followers of Nicholas, but they're people who they're the ones who conquer other people. Nobody really has an answer. The general consensus today seems to be that they were followers of Nicholas, and you say, well, what did they teach? And the answer is, they obviously taught people to eat idol meat and fornicate. Beyond that, we really don't have a clue, but we've got some ideas. But yes, other things we observe right away from the text. Well, okay, so Old Nick for Satan. I'm not sure where that term comes from. I don't think that it was overtly satanic, because this clearly was a heresy that was infecting the early church. And again, when we look at what they were accused of, they were people, the Nicolaitans, the eating idol meat and fornicating, that was those who followed the teaching of Balaam. You've also got the teaching of the Nicolaitans, so I apologize. They seem to be connected. The followers of the teachings of Balaam seem to be following the idol meat and fornicating, the teachings of the Nicolaitans. There's some guess that it may be related to that, but we really don't know for sure. But we do know that it's related. It was an early Christian teaching somehow, and it was destructive enough for Jesus to congratulate those who hated the works of the Nicolaitans. So we see that in chapter 2. Verse 6, when he talks to the church in Ephesus. There's something there. What exactly there is, not really sure. But it was clearly a Christian heresy. It was, so if it were satanic, it wouldn't have been overtly satanic. But you're right to make a connection somehow between these heresies and Satan. It's clearly satanic, but not openly satanic. Other observations or things that we want to notice right away? What's the white pebble? We'll get to the white pebble. But yes, that is an excellent question. Incidentally, also, what is the hidden manna? The church in Pergamum is very interesting, because the church in Pergamum has it's got the teaching of Balaam, which is relatively clear, but it's got the Nicolaitans, it's got the hidden manna, and it's got the white pebble. It's got these three things that stand out as people really aren't sure what they are. And so it's a fun one to try to interpret. Okay, so that's a really good point. So literally it says in my translation, to the, and there actually isn't even one, it's simply implied that it's the one who does these things, but to the conquering, or to the conqueror, I shall give to him some of the manna that was hidden, and I shall give him a white pebble, and upon the pebble a new name written which no one knows except the one taking it. So here's one of the things that may actually help everybody in your Bible study in the future. In English, we've got a couple ways of talking about a person when we don't know, when we're talking about a people in general. So we can use the third person masculine in English. You can say, well, we can use he to refer to an unknown person or an imaginary person or somebody like that, or a general statement. We can also use the third person plural. We can say, you know, to those who overcome, or whoever overcome, well, whoever is a singular, but to those who overcome, we can use the third person plural. We can use the second person plural. You guys, if you overcome, you will have that. So we can have like a generalized statement, but we also use the second person singular. So we would say, you know, and this is probably around us, this is kind of the most common one we use in conversation. So let's say Deanne and I are talking, and she's like, you know, Luke, how do you translate the word machaira? Okay, we already mentioned that's the word sword, right? So I say, well, you know, if you're going to come up and translate that word, or that's a bad example. She'd say, what's your process of trying to find out what a word means? I say, well, if you want to find out what a word means, you do this. So I can be saying that to you if you want to know what that means. But in English, we also use the second person singular to mean a generalized thing. Like, hey, if you're going to replace your windows, you want to do it this way. You want to make sure you go to a preferred contractor who checks out with the Better Business Bureau. We do that in English. Greek does not. When Greek wants to talk about a general person, typically it uses the third person singular. So it can be, Brian, like you mentioned, it can be referring to a single individual, the one who conquers, or it could be referring to anyone who does conquer. And I would say probably here, because we have this repetition to each of the churches, it's the context probably demands us to say, this is a generalized offer of anybody who overcomes, to the one who overcomes, I will give him this. And that's a general invitation. Now, I mean, you could theoretically interpret that as to mean only one individual is going to overcome from that church. I mean, it would be accurate, and I think you'd have a hard time disproving it, but I don't know that that would... I don't know why that would make sense in the context of that being an invitation to others, because if it's an invitation to others, obviously Jesus is intending lots and lots of people to take this advice rather than a single person. But that's a good observation, because there are other places in the Bible where that happens. So, for example, I can't remember the exact text, but there's a place where Paul says a woman should be silent in church. Well, there's actually a definite article. So Paul is saying, I demand that the woman is silent in church. And so there's a question that's arisen: is Paul using the woman? Greek is weird with the way they use the word the, but is he saying, I'm demanding universally all women to be silent in the church, or is he actually referring to an individual woman who is kind of a loudmouth, and he's telling them, kind of with a wink and a nod, he's like, I'm telling you to make sure the woman, you know the one I'm talking about, is silent in church. You can do that. Now, again, typically you would say, you would add the word that in Greek. You can say the woman, that woman, or that one, but anyways... I'm taking us a little far afield, but just the way the word is used. But the reason this is important is a lot of times in the Bible when we read the word you, like we'll see when you do something or you do this, we read that as being a general invitation to anybody, and it's not. It's not normally. Well, it's not ever in Greek, because that's not how Greek works. Now, it may be an invitation for individuals to do that because it's a command. It's an imperative. But that's not actually what's happening. So, did that make sense to everybody, or did I just make everything really confusing? Okay. So in Greek, you can't just use you, the second person singular. You can't just use that as a general statement. You can use the third person singular, but you can't use the second. So, anyways, other things that stand out to us about the letter to the church in Pergamum. There's one that everybody's missing that you probably aren't asking because you feel like you should know. So Pergamum is another coastal city. It's about 20 miles north of Smyrna, and Smyrna is about 35 miles north of Ephesus. If you look at, you know how Turkey kind of has that kind of a rounded rectangle shape? Ephesus is kind of just below the midline, and Pergamum, I believe, is just above the midline of the of the Anatolian Peninsula. In fact, here I've got a little map here, if I can get it. Yeah, okay, so yes, that is an excellent observation. We will come to that. No. No. Well, I was mentioning the thing I was expecting you guys to ask about was Antipas or Antipas. We don't know who Antipas is. Again, there's a theory that he was an early Christian martyr that we simply don't know anything about. But there's another theory that we'll get to when we jump in there. So for right now, let's go ahead and talk about what we know about the city of Pergamum. So the city of Pergamum, also called Pergamus in the ancient world, was where people believed that ancient parchment came from. The word for parchment is, I believe, pergamena or pergamena. And so Pergamum or Pergamus is where parchment paper came from. Parchment, if you're not familiar, was not paper. Paper, a lot of times we call paper products parchment, you know, like cooking parchment and stuff. But parchment in the ancient world, and there are still a couple people that still make it in America, I think maybe one or two. But it's taking animal skin, and you tan the skin, and then you scrape it so that it's incredibly, incredibly thin, and you tan it when that skin is really, really thin, and then you would lay it down in leaves, and then you could write on it. So it was basically just leather. It was extremely thin leather, and that's what people wrote on. That was before papyrus became widely available as paper product. So people in the ancient world, when they wanted to write, people who were literate would often write on potsherds. So there's they nowadays we call them ostraca. Ostraca, there was a great discovery of them a long time ago, but they would take broken pieces of pottery, and they would, when they wanted to write something, they would take, you know, a relatively hard stylus or a piece of harder rock, or even, you know, moderately hard rock, and they would scrape what they wanted into these markings, and then people would just throw them away because, you know, broken pottery is incredibly cheap, but paper was very expensive, and parchment was extremely expensive. So we know for a fact that parchment was reused. It was used and used and used and used and used. So not only would they take parchment, and when they wanted to correct things, when they look at these ancient manuscripts of the Bible, they can tell where people have written over it, and then where they've just like filled in the lines with modern computer technology, they can tell where they've just written over with the ink. But they've also found a lot of them, they're called palimpsests, and a palimpsest is a piece of paper, and what they would do is a scribe would take a book, maybe an entire book, and they would take these special scrapers. They kind of, you know, look like what you would expect, and they would scrape the leather so that they could scrape the writing off of it, and then they would rewrite it, and they would use them as a book. And they've discovered some of these palimpsests, and with modern technology, they've actually been able to go back and read what was written once, because it still has left a very faint indentation into the paper, because it's very, very fine. Well, I shouldn't say paper, into the parchment. But Pergamum was a place where we believe parchment was invented, or at least it became famous for the invention of parchment. And Pergamum was the capital city. It was the Roman capital of that part of Asia. And this is the really important part about Pergamum. It was both a city of idols. Ephesus was the city of Diana, the temple of Diana. Smyrna was a city, was kind of a resort city. It was a beautiful city. Pergamum was an imperial city. It was the first city in Asia that was allowed to have an emperor cult. And that's important to know. It was the first place that was allowed an emperor cult. And they worshipped the Caesars there. And that was really, really important. And that's really important to understand this. But not only that, but the city was covered with temples. There was the temple, there was a temple of Zeus. There was a temple of Bacchus. There was a temple of I believe there was another temple of Diana. But specifically, and the big one was, there was a temple of Asclepius. Asclepius was the god of healing. Now, in Greek mythology, Asclepius kind of looks like a man, but he was a snake in Anatolian mythology. So in Turkish mythology, Asklepios, that god, the god of healing, was a snake. And that's why we have the snake, you know, climbing up the thing. That's the symbol of medicine. And what they had was they had this huge this huge temple, and it was a place where you would go, and people would go there, and they would get massages. There would be hot baths. They would have people whispering, hidden up in the rafters. You know, as people walked through, they would say, "You're getting better. You'll be healed." And then at night, they would lay down, they would sleep on the floor, and they would let non-venomous snakes crawl all over you. And it was supposed to be your way of connecting with the serpent god. The serpent was connected with wisdom. The serpent was connected with healing. And in fact, it was loved by all the wealthy people. You know, wealthy people have always found ways to get to these resorts throughout history. And Caesar used to go there. History has kind of forgotten this, but Caesar was an alcoholic, and he used to go to Pergamum once a year and dry out. And that was where he went. He went to the temple of Asclepius, and it was a famous temple. I mean, and it lasted for a very, very, very long time. It continued as this temple. So Pergamum was a wealthy city, extremely important city, an imperial city, a city of cult worship, a city of medicine. It had a library it had a university there, which was exceptional, and it had a university library of 200,000 volumes. The university, the Great Library of Alexandria, got its library from Pergamum. It was a gift, or at least many of the volumes were a gift from Antony to Cleopatra, from the library at Pergamum. It was a very wealthy city. It was a very powerful city. The A-T-T-A-I-L-I-A-L-I-A-N, the Italian princes also had their kingdom there. So not only was it the center, was it the seat of Roman authority, the Roman governors, but also the local kings had their place there. And then you had the emperor cult was there, and you had the cult of Asclepius and all of these other gods that were there. It was a very, very intimidating city. It was a very powerful city. It was a very influential city. So with that in mind, with that bit of background, let's go ahead and jump right into the text here. So to the angel, again, we've talked about, I think the angel there is the pastor of the church, which we should all just get in the habit of calling the pastors of our churches angels, I think. Angel can mean, for those listening at home, I am rightly getting my chops busted here, so very deservedly, but yes. Actually, now that I say that, I'm kind of hoping that nickname doesn't catch on. So, yes, Emily has said, I am not an angel. But to the angel, we could also translate that messenger. I think some of the modern translations have translated that messenger. But to the pastor, the chief elder in the church, in the Pergamum church, you shall write, "Thus says the one having the sharp, two-mouthed broadsword." Okay, let's just pause right there. We've already talked about this a little bit, but the two-mouthed broadsword. Now, it's interesting that, remember, John is a master of wordplay. John is going to give us, in the Revelation, these hints and these clues of the connections we're supposed to make. So part of the reason why I've given you this incredibly painful, hard-to-read, not very good translation is because I want us to see these verbal connections that John is making in Greek that just... To make a good translation in English, you have to steamroll over those things. You can't carry them through, or it doesn't make much sense. So he has this sharp, two-mouthed broadsword. And look at verse 16. "Repent, therefore, and if not, I come to you quickly, and I shall war against them with what? Broadsword of my mouth." So he's the one who has the two-mouthed broadsword, but he also has a broadsword of what? Broadsword of his mouth. So we see this repetition of the mouth. And then if we go to Revelation chapter 19, which is on page, in my translation, is page, looks like 47. Look at verse... Ah, there we go. verse 14 on page 49, chapter 19, verse 14. And the soldiers in heaven followed him, that is Jesus, who's returned from heaven. He's on a white horse and all that. Upon white horses, clothed in pure white fine linen, and out of his mouth is coming a sharp broadsword. Okay, so what we see here is this connection, and we're going to see this again, that he destroys them with the sword of his mouth. We're gonna see that again in this chapter. But there's a connection here that John is establishing at the beginning. Now remember, I've probably mentioned this several times already. The things that John is saying here in the first couple chapters, we're also going to see in the last couple chapters. This is very typical of John. It's very typical of ancient writing. What happens at the beginning is repeated at the end. That's just classic ancient writing. And John is establishing these themes. But what we see here is he's announcing himself to be the one who has the sword. And he's telling his church, I have the sword. He has already threatened the church at Ephesus that he would take away their lampstand. And here he is telling them that there are people in the church who will be treated like unbelievers, which is exactly what Brian said. He will indiscriminately destroy those who are disobeying him. And maybe indiscriminately is a bad word, but I think it does get at the image. He is not going to be careful in doling out judgment on those who oppose him. And the reality is, and maybe I think Brian's example of this, you know, kind of these big swings of this big broadsword is pretty accurate, because when God judges the church, innocent people do suffer. Like that you guys are all old enough, you guys know this. When you live in a fallen world, innocent people suffer. Like that is a consequence of living in a world where there's sin. A consequence of being part of a church where there is horrific sin, idol worship, and fornication, there will be judgment that falls upon the righteous as well as the guilty. But he tells them, I have known where you dwell. Again, notice he doesn't start with, I know your works. He knows the works of the Ephesians. He doesn't start with the works of the church at Smyrna, but every other church he's going to tell them that he knows their works. Here, he doesn't begin with their works. He says, I know where you dwell. Whom else does he know where someone dwells? Satan. I know where you dwell. You dwell where Satan dwells. Satan has his throne in your city. Satan dwells in your city. We'll come to that in just a second. But he's telling them, I know where you dwell. It is important that they recognize that what is significant for this church, what separates them from other churches, is their dwelling. They live in a unique place. Not just a unique time in history, because we all live in unique times in history, but even in that time, in that apostolic age, the church at Pergamum was in a unique place. They were in a uniquely challenging situation. Because, why? Because they were in the city where Satan had his throne. They were in the city where Satan dwells. I've also put a note here at the bottom, and I'll just read the note for those listening at home. Here is one of the most important words in Revelation. Ketoiketo means to dwell, and the word, the root word is oikos, which means house. So if you ever get oikos yogurt, oikos Greek yogurt, it's house. That's the word oikos or oikia. So to dwell in something is kaoikeo. Now this is contrasted with the word skeno, the verb skeno, which means to pitch a tent. Now the word to pitch tent, skeno, is used exclusively of two people in John's theology and in the Revelation. Skeno, to pitch a tent, is what believers do in the world and what God will do when he's on earth. So this is an important distinction. The people who dwell on this earth, those who are dwelling upon the earth, and that's an expression that we're going to see over and over and over and over in Revelation. John is constantly telling us about those who dwell upon the earth, those who dwell upon the earth, those who dwell upon the earth. That word is katoikeo, the ones who make their homes on the earth. But believers, they skeno in heaven. They pitch their tent in heaven. And God skenos, he pitches his tent on earth. I think what he's telling us is, the worldlings are at home in the world. This is part of John's theology. We actually have, if you read some older translations of the book of John, in John 1:1, you know, we have the word put on flesh and dwelt among us. Some people will say tabernacled. among us. You know, it's this idea of when Jesus put on flesh and he lived among us, he was pitching a tent. It was a temporary thing. This is not his natural home. Well, when God dwells with us in the future, we're going to see this in Revelation 22, it's this verb skeno. Now, believers skeno with God when we are taken up to be in heaven with him. We pitch our tent with him. But the unbelievers, they are at home in this world. This is their home. So there's a really interesting theology that John is working out. He's playing with something with these words that's pretty significant, and we'll see how that's used throughout the rest of the text. But he says, I know where you dwell, where is the throne of Satan, and you hold my name, and you didn't deny my faith, even in the days of Antipas, my faithful testifier who was killed from you or out of you or from among you, where Satan dwells. Satan is mentioned twice here in this opening introduction. And he says, I know where you dwell. And then when he talks about where they dwell, it's not a nice thing. You dwell where the throne of Satan is. Now, there are a lot of theories about what it means for Satan's throne to be there. There, of course, was the mighty temple of Zeus that was in the city of Pergamum. People talk about that as being the throne of Satan. People talk about the temple of Asclepius, remember, with all the snakes and all the serpents, and people say, well, that's a natural link to being the throne of Satan. Other people talk about the emperor cult being there. Some people talk about it being a general thing because there was so much idolatry there. That's what's being intended. And some people are saying, well, it's just a general statement that they have a uniquely pagan city that they were living in. The interpretation that I like is that this is just where Satan's actual throne is. Satan actually had his throne in the city of Pergamum. That was where Satan set up his base of operations. We know from reading the book of Daniel, if we go to Daniel chapter, I don't remember off the top of my head. Daniel prayed and prayed and prayed, and he didn't get an answer for a long time. And when he finally did get an answer, the one who answers him said, you know, immediately after you prayed, I went out, but I was hindered by whom? Does anybody remember off the top of their head? By the prince of Persia. The prince of Persia hindered me. And he said, I battled with him, and then Michael came and helped me overcome him, and I defeated the prince of Persia, and then he gave the rest of his message to Daniel. So if we look at, again, we look at Daniel, we look at some other passages in the New Testament, not a lot of them, but we look at those, and then we look at what we have here. To me, the simplest answer is that Satan is not in hell. We know Satan isn't in hell because hell hasn't been opened up. Hell won't be opened up until Satan is cast into the fire in Revelation 21. And I think that Satan is, we know that Satan sometimes is up in heaven accusing the brethren, but I think Satan has a base, has a headquarters. Satan is not omnipresent. Satan can't be everywhere at once. He is limited in, he is not omniscient. He doesn't know everything. He's not omnipotent. He's not all-powerful, and he's not omnipresent. He can only be at one place at one time. And we know that Satan has, because of terminology we see in the Bible, there are thrones, principalities, powers. Satan has a hierarchy of demons. I think he just had a base of operations, and I think at this time it was in Pergamum. Now, could it have been in Pergamum for all of these reasons? Sure, that may well have been. You know, is this a hill I'm willing to die on? No, like this isn't even a hill I'm willing to light a firecracker on, but I think that it's the most natural and easiest interpretation of the text. I think taking it at face value is the easiest interpretation. Before we move on, does anybody have any questions or comments? Okay, so you dwell where the throne of Satan is, but then we get this commendation. So he's saying, I know how hard it is for you to live there. I know that this is a terrible city you live in. And despite the fact, and he doesn't say this, but you could almost read, and even though you live in this city, you hold my name, and you didn't deny my faith. Now, interesting, that's a past tense. He's not saying you're currently holding to my name. He's saying you didn't deny my faith, even in the days of Antipas, my faithful testifier, who was killed from among you. Again, who is Antipas? People wax eloquent about this, you know, with his name meaning against all, that maybe he's, you know, he's Athanasius contra mundum. He's the one who's against everybody, and the whole city of Pergamum was against him, and he got this nickname. I mean, maybe, or maybe his name was just Antipas. I mean, we know that was a relatively common name in the ancient world, so
Again, I think the simplest solution is that was his name, and he's just somebody whose name has been lost to us in history, other than, you know, the Bible talking about him. But there must have been a very violent persecution that happened in the city of Pergamum in these days. And these people that Jesus is writing to, they hadn't denied the faith. They held to the faith. And Jesus is telling them, and he's saying, you are like the one, the faithful testifier. Now, where have we seen terminology like this? We've already seen this. Jesus is the one who's the faithful testifier. He's the one with the faithful testimony. So we see a connection between Antipas, who suffers for his God and who doesn't deny the name of his God, and his God himself. So we see this connection that's being made. Again, the revelation is full of these wordplays, and the more, the problem is you want to highlight them. This is what I did. When I started going through Revelation, I started highlighting all these like really cool wordplay connections, and then it ended up that the entire book was highlighted and didn't do me a whole lot of good because I couldn't remember. You know, you only got so many highlighter colors, and you can't remember all of them. So we've got that, and he was killed from you where Satan dwells. This reiteration that happens, that the city is under the influence of Satan. However, verse 14, I have a few things against you, that there are ones who hold to the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the sons of Israel. And then he explains, to eat idle meat and fornicate. Now, if we were to go back to Numbers chapter 22, Numbers 22, does anybody remember the broad stroke story of Balaam? Okay, what's the story of Balaam? So if I say Balaam's ass, will you all know what I'm talking about? Balaam's ass? You guys remember that story? So Balaam was a prophet, Balaam son of Beor, and he was a Gentile prophet, and he was famous that everything he said would come true. And, okay, you remember the story now? So what happens? Yeah, I mean, that did happen, but the big idea of the story is Balaam was the prophet, and Balak, who was the king of the Midianites, sent messengers to Balaam and said, hey, Balaam, I want you to come, and I want you to curse the Israelites. This is before the Israelites came into the land. Numbers 22 through 26 is this saga. And Balaam says, I can't go. I can't go unless the Lord sends me, unless Yahweh sends me. Sends another servant. Hey, he'll give you all this stuff if you go. I can't go unless Yahweh sends me. Sends a third servant. And he says, I can't go. And then finally, God says, Balaam, I want you to go. Weird. Okay, so Balaam starts going. And then, after God tells him to go, he's on the way, and he's passing through, like, between two vineyards or something. There's walls on either side. And all of a sudden, his donkey, like, keeps pushing up against the wall, and it smashes his leg, and he starts beating his donkey. It does it again. He starts beating his donkey. Finally, the donkey lays down on the ground, and he starts beating the crap out of his donkey. And his donkey looks at him and says, why are you doing this? And Balaam flips out because his donkey is talking, and then God opens his eyes, and he looks, and he sees an angel with a drawn sword. And the angel tells him, why have you beaten your donkey these three times? And he says, well, I didn't know you were there, my lord. And because the donkey, remember what the donkey says, aren't I your donkey that you've always ridden your whole life? Because donkeys live a long time. And he's like, yeah. And so he sees, and God says through the angel, your path is a reckless one. So even though, so what's happening is Balaam really wanted to go, but he didn't think he should. But he really wanted to go because he wanted to get all the treasure that the king would give him for cursing Israel. But he knew that he shouldn't do it. And God is telling him, your path is a reckless one. I'm sending you on this mission so that you can prophesy to this king about the truth of Yahweh. And you can make prophecies, but you need to be very, very careful. So it's a really interesting story. God is telling him to do something that he didn't want to do. Balaam knew that he would be tempted, and God says, go ahead and do it anyways. But you need to be very careful. So he goes, and Balak comes to Balaam, and he says, I want you to curse Israel. And he looks at Israel, and what does he do? He gives this amazing first oracle. And he basically says, you know, I'm just going to paraphrase, Israel is wonderful, that their enemies are going to eat dust, and they're invincible. And Balaam's really mad because he's like sacrificed like 7 bulls and like 14 sheep or something. There's this huge sacrifice, this huge put on. And he's like, why are you blessing them? I brought you here to curse them. And Balaam says to Balak, I can't curse anyone whom God blesses. I can only say what Yahweh tells me to say. And he's like, okay, well, let me take you to this other mountain where you can see a different portion of them. And he, again, they go through the whole rigmarole, and instead of cursing them, he blesses them. And then they do it again, and then he curses them and blesses them. And then finally, we see in chapter 24, verse 1. Now, when Balaam saw that it pleased the Lord to bless Israel, he did not resort to sorcery as at other times, but he turned his face toward the desert. When Balaam looked out and saw Israel encamped tribe by tribe, the Spirit of God came upon him, and he uttered his oracle. The oracle of Balaam, son of Beor, the oracle of the one whose eye sees clearly, the oracle of the one who hears the words of God, who sees a vision from the Almighty, who falls prostrate and whose eyes are opened. How beautiful are your tents, O Jacob, your dwelling places, O Israel. Like valleys they spread out, like gardens beside a river, like aloes planted by the Lord, like cedars beside the waters. Water will flow from their buckets, their seed will have abundant water. Their king will be greater than Agag, their kingdom will be exalted. God brought them out of Egypt. They have the strength of a wild ox. They devour hostile nations. They break their bones in pieces. With their arrows they pierce them. Like a lion they crouch and lie down, like a lioness who dares to rouse them. May those who bless you be blessed. May those who curse you be cursed. And then Balak's anger burned even more. And he says, I brought you here to curse him, and all you've done is bless him. And then Balak says to him, I would have rewarded you handsomely, but your God has prevented you from being rewarded. Like a really cool story about how Balaam is great. Balaam utters another oracle. But then we find out that it doesn't end there. Because Balaam really, really, really wanted money. A lot. And so he helped Balak, and he told Balak this plan. And basically it was this. Balak, this is Balaam talking. Balak, you hate Israel, right? Yes. Because you're afraid of Israel, right? Yes. Because you're afraid they're going to come and they're going to devour your land and take your land away. Yes. Okay, here's what you do. Send some of your best-looking young women to go and fornicate with the men and get them to eat idol meat, to sacrifice to false gods. Because if they worship other gods, their God Yahweh will be angry with them and smite them, and then you won't be in danger anymore. We know from Jude, this is also called Balaam's error. Balaam's error and Balaam's sin are different things, but we're not talking about that tonight. We'll talk about Balaam's error another time. But Balaam believed, he presumed wrongly. Actually, I will talk about it. That's Balaam's error. He presumed wrongly that if somebody sins, that God cannot bless them. They thought that God was bound by the things that bound their gods. God found a way to bless those who sin against him. That's, again, but they put out this plan. And their plan worked really, really well. Because what happened? They started sinning, where? In Peor. Remember the sin of Peor? They were fornicating with these Moabituses, and everything was going badly, and the people are mourning. There's this plague that strikes the Israelites, and then it seems like this plan has worked. It seems like the Israelites are going to be stopped. It seems as though Balak and the Midianites are going to defeat the Israelites because God is going to continue to curse the Israelites because they continue to worship idols, to eat meat sacrificed to idols, and to commit fornication with foreign women. Except there was one guy that Balaam hadn't prophesied or foreseen, and that was Phinehas. Phinehas sees this guy and this girl go into a tent, this man and this Midianite woman, and he goes in and he runs a spear through both of them, and God stops the plague. And God says, because Phinehas was as jealous for my honor as I am, I will give him an everlasting priesthood. So the sin of Balaam was to cast a stumbling block before people. It was to entice people with sin. And so what he's saying is, you have some who hold to the teaching of Balaam. What was the teaching of Balaam? The teaching of Balaam was Balaam telling Balak, hey, I want you to send your women out to fornicate with these men and to get them to sacrifice idols. There were people in that church who were convincing other people to do that. They were convincing other people to fornicate and to worship idols. And it was casting a stumbling block before the people. And God says that he had that against them. And he says again in verse 15, in this manner you also have ones holding the teachings of the Nicolaitans likewise. Let me just pause. Is there anything like what we read about the Church of Pergamum that sounds familiar? We have people who call themselves Christians today who encourage sexual immorality. Yeah. Do we have people who call themselves Christians today who encourage people to worship other gods? Yeah. Do we have people in the church today who encourage people to get go in for worldliness? Absolutely. Absolutely. These are perennial threats. This is not just a threat that was a one-off. I mean, we don't have people, well, I guess we actually do today, but we typically don't think of people who are idolaters as people who bow down before, you know, wooden and bronze fetishes. There are people who do that, but we've got all sorts of people today, all sorts of people who call themselves Christians who talk about how, you know, how you can go in for the world. You can be worldly. You can just be like folks. You're not fine. It's not okay. Fornication is still a sin. Worshipping false gods is still a sin. It doesn't matter how cool and how au courant it is. It doesn't matter how culturally accepted it is. It's still a sin, and God hates it. And God especially hates it when people who are supposed to be teachers are encouraging people to do these kinds of things. It's interesting. He doesn't say, now think about this. I want you to catch this. He doesn't say, I have against you that you have people who are doing these things. He's saying you've got those who hold to that teaching. It may be that means that the people who act out the teaching, and that's certainly a curse. But it seems like he emphasizes the teacher, the one who leads others astray. Remember who's the recipient of this letter. It's not directly intended for the entire church. It's for the pastor. He says, you've got people holding to the teaching of Balaam. Well, who's teaching the teaching of Balaam? He might be. It would certainly seem as though the pastor in that church is, if he is not teaching it himself, he is not taking a hard enough stand against sin. He's certainly permitting it, right? And Jesus is telling him, I've got this against you. That you there is a singular you. Remember, you is not used as a generalized statement. In Greek, that singular you means you as an individual. It's not, I have this against people in general. I have this against you. He's telling him, who's supposed to be in charge here? Who's supposed to be the one responsible for teaching? You are. And you've got people holding to the teaching of Balaam. You've got people in your church who are fornicating and who are eating idol meat. Whose fault is that? Well, it's their fault. It's his fault, too. Because somebody's teaching them to do these things. Somebody has led on to them that it's acceptable to do these things. Now, granted, pastors are not responsible for what everybody does. People can do things contrary to good teaching. That has always been true. That's always has been true, always will be true. But Jesus would not be bringing this up with him, with the emphasis on teaching of Balaam, if he was not giving a wink and a nod at this. I think here's my theory. I think that things were really hard in Pergamum. Now, maybe you're going to say, Lukey, you're just imposing your modern context, your American context on this. I think things were very hard in Pergamum. They suffered an awful lot. And I think that he saw these people who had suffered for the name of Jesus. They'd lost their property. They'd face persecution. And they start maybe sleeping around. Maybe just to get through the day. They'll eat some idol meat just so they don't offend anybody, so they don't cause a stir, so they don't have to bring any more persecution on themselves. They're just doing what they need to get by. They haven't denied Jesus' name, but they're also not going out of their way to be contrary. They're not going out of their way to stand for Christ in a corrupt world. And they keep going in for worldliness little by little by little until eventually they can't be differentiated from the world. Eventually they look just like the world. You know, in today's context, it would be, look, we've got, our churches are so small, we can't afford to offend anybody. We can't afford to make anybody mad because, I mean, we got 50 people. You make five of them mad, you just lost, what, 10% of your church? Our church is so small, we can't afford to lose anybody. So you got to give a wink and a nod at sin. Not sure that that's what the one who holds the sharp two-mouthed broadsword would say, but it's... Anyways, I'm just talking now. Verse 16, repent therefore, and if not, I will come to you, singular, second person singular you quickly, and I shall war with who? With them, with the broadsword of my mouth. Again, I think Brian is right. The buck stops with the angel of the church in Ephesus. He is responsible for some of this. But I think, but notice that distinction. I shall come to you and I shall war with them. He's telling him, listen, you're going to get by on this, but they're not. You are giving a wink and a nod at this behavior, and it is going to lead to me making war with them with the sword of my mouth. And when Jesus makes war with the sword of his mouth, that means hell. That's what Revelation 19 is all about. They go to eternal lostness. And he's saying, you've got people that are in your church, people, and this was a house church. You've got people coming to your house, and you're teaching them the Bible, and they are going to go to hell because you are winking and nodding at their sin. Because you are so afraid to stand for truth. To the one having an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. Again, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches, plural. I think I've already hinted at this, but I think, and we'll talk about this at the end when we summarize all these churches, but the Spirit is saying this to the churches. He's not just saying this to the church of Pergamum. This is what the Spirit is saying to the churches, plural. Now, does he mean, hey, every church needs to listen to the specific message that's meant for them, and because there are multiple churches with multiple messages, that's why we use the plural churches? Yeah, I think so. But what do we also know about the book of Revelation? It's a book where there's a guaranteed blessing for the reader and the hearer. We know that it's a church. That what he says is, to the one having an ear. So this is anybody. Anybody who listens to this and can listen to the lesson that's being taught to the church at Pergamum, there's a message for you. There's a message for everybody in the church at Pergamum. To the one conquering, I shall give him some of the manna that was hidden. All right, so really quickly, the hidden manna. There are a couple theories about the hidden manna. The one that I like best, personally, is it goes back to the tabernacle. And so if you remember right, the Israelites were fed for 40 years in the desert, and they fed them with manna, and then they took a pot of manna, they took a small pot of it, and they put it into the Ark of the Covenant. And then they put that in the tabernacle, and eventually that went into the temple. And so the Ark of the Covenant actually has a lot of beautiful symbolism of Jesus Christ, but because there were three things in the tabernacle. Does anybody remember what the three things were in the ark? Aaron's rod that budded. The tablets of stone and the hidden manna. Yep. So, and Dr. McGee does a great job. So we have the tablets of stone, we have the law that condemns. And it brings what? It brings death. We have Aaron's rod that budded. It was an almond staff. Almond wood is really dry wood, and a staff is already dead because it's a staff. What's that? It's life out of death. What does Christ bring us? He brings us life out of death. And finally, we have the pot of manna. It is a supernatural supply of food. So that is a picture of Christ in his threefold ministry. He is the lawgiver. He is the one who pays the penalty of the law, and he is the one who is the life giver as well. So he's going to give us some of the hidden manna, and also a lot of people believe, and I think it's true as well, the hidden manna is a reference to Christ himself. I think it's an Old Testament allusion to that manna that was in the tabernacle, but that manna in the tabernacle is a reference to Jesus Christ and his ministry. He is the bread of heaven. And by the way, don't miss that, because John chapter 6, remember, John wrote the Revelation, John wrote John chapter 6. You cannot miss the allusion to Jesus feeding the Israelites in the desert when you read John chapter 6, mostly because Jesus says it very plainly, right? Like, what do they do? They come to Jesus, and they're like, hey, Jesus, we want a miraculous sign. And he's like, oh, yeah, what kind of miraculous sign do you want me to give? I'm like, well, Moses gave people bread in the desert, so this is after Jesus provided them bread. It's like, are you guys that hungry right now? Like, did you guys not eat breakfast, right? But he says, it is not Moses who gave you bread, but my Father who gives you the true bread from heaven. And Jesus says, I am the bread of life. Whoever eats of my flesh, et cetera, et cetera. You guys know the passage. And then we have the white pebble. And I'm sorry I'm going a little bit over time here. There are a ton of theories about the white pebble. Some people point to the white pebble being a diamond, and they say, well, a white stone is a diamond, and diamonds are really pretty, and there's a name written on it, and maybe it's, you know, a special message from Jesus. It's a gift from Jesus. Maybe. Some people point to the fact that in a lot of the ancient world, when there were judgments made about people, there would be black stones and white stones, and when there was a trial, and a white stone was for an acquittal, so if you had a white stone, you would be acquitted of your crime. That's got some good argument too. There's one other view that I think is worth considering, and that is, has anybody ever heard of a tessera? Have you guys ever heard the expression to tessellate, like a tessellated ceiling, or like a tessellated mosaic? So a tessera was a small stone, and sometimes it could be like a piece of mosaic stone, so it was square, or it could be cubic, and it could be made of a lot of things. It could be made of glass, it could be made of clay, it could be made of actual stone itself, or it could be made of wood. But all throughout the ancient world, they used these things. They used these things for a ton of different reasons. They were called tessera, or tesserae is the plural. And they had all these different uses. And white stones, if they could get soft white stone, this was a really common thing to use for the tessera. And they would be messages. So sometimes they would be messages with special names, like friends would give them to each other. And it was called a tessera hospitalis. And so if you wanted to show hospitality to a friend, you would give them a tessera hospitalis. And this could be passed down from generation to generation. There were other uses of these tessera, and there's actually a lot of literature on that if you're interested. It's kind of obscure, but I think that's what's being referred to here. It was big in Roman culture. Remember, Pergamum went in big for Roman culture, and this idea of these small stones, the Roman army used them, the Roman legal system used them, but this idea is when you would give a stone with a name written on it, it was saying that there was some kind of obligation given. Like, if you gave somebody a tessera hospitalis, it was a free invitation to come to your home whenever you need hospitality. I think that's what's envisioned here. I think Jesus is saying, I'm going to invite you to my home. The one who overcomes, I'm going to invite you to my home. I'm going to give you this white stone with his name on it. Nobody else can get the name because nobody else is invited but the one who overcomes, and this will be your invitation to come to be where I am. Anyways, does anybody have any questions or comments or criticisms here about the Church of Pergamum? Well, thank you, everybody. I appreciate you guys, and I hope this was a good study.